here. She made her living as a scryer.
What's a scryer?
Kate asked. Her hands were balled deep in the pockets of her coat, and she had turned her head to look at him. Only the boy's eyes reflected the lights from the street. His face was in shadow. He kept his gaze fixed upon the window.
It's someone who can see things that ain't there. She'd take a bowl of water, pour in some oil, and then she could see whatever she wanted to, no matter how far away, and people would pay her to show 'em things. Sometimes it'd be when they'd lost something valuable, like a ring or a watch or something. More often it'd be people who'd just come to New York wanting to see the ones they'd left behind, their mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters. Sometimes parents looking at children, watching 'em grow up in my ma's bowl. She did it for everyone, magic and normal folk alike. They all loved her for it. Our apartment was only one room. I used to be there, behind the blanket that hid my bed, and I would watch 'em, men and women, crying, hugging her. She never asked for much money, just enough for us to live.
Who lives there now?
No one. I pay the rent myself. The old woman lives below. She comes up every night and turns on the light.
And you come up here and watch, Kate thought, and imagine your mother's still alive.
Then he said again, quietly, everyone loved her.
And Kate knew he was talking about himself. They were both silent. Kate could sense that the boy was gearing up for what he had to tell her, and that there was no need to press. He began speaking again, with no warning.
So, one night this man comes to our apartment. He said he wanted to see his wife, and I remember he threw down all this money. He was drunk and calling his wife names. Show her to me, she's hiding, show her to me. I was there behind the blanket separating my bed from the apartment, and I watched my mother get out her bowl and pour the oil in it and light the candle. And she told the man she'd need something from the woman, like a lock of hair or something that had belonged to her, and the man laughed, and he reached into his pocket, and he threw down a silver ring. It was a wedding ring, I could tell. I saw my mother take it, and she was real still, you know, real quiet. And she put the ring into the bowl, and I could see her whispering and concentrating real hard, and the man was breathing loud and heavy. And he started asking, what do you see? Where is she? Where's she hiding? And my mother said nothing for a long time. Then she looked up from the bowl, and she said, did you do that to her? And the man, he started cursing her, saying she was magic scum, and it was none of her business, and if she didn't want the same done to her and worse, she'd tell him where the woman was. And my ma just took the bowl of water and splashed it on the floor and told him to get the hell out.
The boy paused, his gaze still fixed on the lit window across the street.
He knocked her down to the floor. I ran out and was screaming at the man and hitting him, and I could hear my ma yelling at me to get back, and the man hit me, and my head banged the wall, and it all went black. When I woke up, the room was quiet, and I was on the floor, and my ma was lying beside me on the floor, and she was dead.
Kate stared at the boy, hardly able to believe what he was saying, that this had happened, her heart breaking for him. Rafe went on. He hadn't finished his story.
They buried Mama in Pauper's Field. I got back from the funeral, and there were people who wanted to put me in a home. But I hid. See, I knew who the man was. He owned a butcher's a few blocks over. No one had arrested him or nothing. They were all normal humans. Him, the cops. So that night, after the funeral, I snuck in his shop, and when he came in the next morning, I took one of his own knives and stabbed him through the heart. People seen me do it and come after me, That was when Miss B saved me."
He fell silent, and the city seemed quiet around them.
"Thing is, my ma always told me I had a destiny," she said. "When you get older, you'll have to choose. She always said that, you'll have to choose." Then she died. And years later, I had this dream. I saw this person. I didn't know what it meant, so I went to this witch. She's young, but real powerful. She can see things. She told me that the person in my dream would show me who I was, what my destiny was.
He looked at Kate.
"It was you in my dream. That was how I recognized you."
Their faces were only inches apart. Kate couldn't move.
"But she told me," the boy went on, "that after I find out the truth, you'll die. That's why you've got to leave. Promise me that tomorrow you'll leave. You'll go up north or wherever, but you'll get away from me. Promise."
And then he reached into his pocket and pulled out something, and Kate saw that it was her mother's locket. And not only that, it was strung on a golden chain. And it was her mother's gold chain. And she realized he must have gotten it that afternoon, tracked down the man who'd sold her the coat. And she felt a tightness in her heart as she reached around her neck and fastened the clasp.
"There. Now you got everything. You have to go."
They climbed down the fire escape and began walking through the streets. Kate assumed they were heading to the church, but she didn't ask. She found her hand in his. But if she had taken his hand or if he had taken hers, she couldn't say. Neither spoke. It had begun snowing once again. 3 blocks from his mother's apartment, the party from a dance hall suddenly flowed out into the street, the revelers and musicians streaming around the boy and girl, and, as the band struck up, 50 people began dancing all around them. Rafe turned toward her. Kate had never danced with a boy before and wasn't sure what to do. But without a word, Rafe put one hand around her waist and took her free hand in his own and guided her in a slow, spinning circle around the snowy street. She felt his fingers wind through hers, and soon she rested her head on his shoulder. She imagined she could feel his heart beating against her chest. Kate wished she could reach inside herself and call up the magic to stop time.
"I could live here," she thought, "in this moment."
The song finally came to an end. The band began playing another, but Kate and Rafe stayed as they were, in the midst of the turning men and women. At some point, Kate tasted salt and realized she was crying. Rafe stepped back.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
She stared at him. He had the eyes of her enemy.
But he wasn't her enemy. He couldn't be. "It's about him, isn't it? The Dire Magnus. Tell me, please. Whatever it is you're afraid of, it doesn't have to happen. We can change it."
Kate nodded. She had to tell him. He deserved to know. And maybe, just maybe...
"Rafe!"
A small shape was pushing through the crowd of dancers. It was Beatles. His face was flushed and terrified.
"You gotta come! You gotta come now! They're burning the church!"
Chapter 17. The Hostage. The smoke rose in a thick column from somewhere past the curve of the valley. There were no sounds to be heard. Even the birds had fallen silent. Michael stood with his sister and Gabriel atop the half-demolished tower.
"How do we even know it's him?" Emma asked. "Maybe someone just, you know, forgot to put out their campfire."
Gabriel said nothing, but continued staring down the valley.
"Here I am."
They all turned as Wilhelmina appeared at the top of the stairs. She was flushed from running up the tower, her cheeks like 2 pink peaches.
"Stop it," Michael told himself.
The elf princess was carrying a large, shallow clay bowl and a small jar, and she had a water skin slung over her shoulder. She knelt on the landing and set the clay bowl carefully before her.
"This is Zanbertus's scrying bowl. It will allow us to see what is transpiring in the valley."
She poured out an inch or so of water from the skin, then unstoppered the small jar and dribbled a crescent of oil across the surface.
"Gather close."
Gabriel and the children knelt around the bowl. Michael felt Wilhelmina slip her hand into his, and he thought about protesting, then let the matter go. Almost immediately an image began to appear in the bowl. It was both clear and strangely fluid. Michael likened it to watching television at the bottom of a pool. Emma let out a gasp.
"Screeches! I never seen so many!"
They were looking at a scene taking place in the forest. A score of black-clad creatures carrying swords and crossbows were moving quickly through the gloom of the great trees. It was a fearsome sight, and all the worse, Michael reflected, as the screeches were not alone.
"What is that thing?"
With his free hand, Michael pointed to one of the thick-bodied figures marching beside the Morum Cardi. The creature had leathery-looking skin and carried a barbed mace. Short yellow tusks jabbed upward from its jaw.
"An imp," Gabriel said. "A foot soldier of the Dire Magnus. I have had dealings with them before."
"That means he killed a whole bunch of them," Emma said.
Michael ignored this, saying,
"When did they get here? They must have been climbing into the valley all night."
Gabriel said,
"Show us where the smoke is coming from."
Wilhelmina dribbled in more oil. The image before them dissolved, and a new one rose to take its place. At first they could only make out a large pale blob. Then the picture snapped into focus, and Emma cried out and leaped to her feet.
"That's him!"
She pointed down at the bald man whose head now filled the bowl.
"That's the guy Dr. Pym stayed behind to fight."
"So it is Rourke,"
Gabriel said, and there was a note of finality in his voice, as if some chance or hope had been extinguished.
"Can we see more?"
The elf princess moved her hand over the bowl, and it was like a camera pulling back. The image widened, revealing Rourke standing in the same clearing that Emma had been taken from the night before. And behind him, where the elves had placed the sculpture of Wilhelmina, they saw that an archway had been fashioned out of newly cut trees. It was perhaps 15 feet high and 10 feet wide, and flames coursed along the wooden struts, sending up a spiral of black smoke.
"Look," Michael said. "Do you see?"
Imps and screeches in twos and threes were stepping out of the flaming archway and into the clearing. But the strange thing, what had drawn Michael's and now drew the others' attention, was that the creatures were not passing through from one side to the other. Rather, they seemed simply to materialize beneath the crossbeam, as if appearing out of thin air.
"Rourke has created a portal," Gabriel said. "He must have come through the mountains with a small band. Then he made this gateway to transport the rest of his army."
"Well, so he's got an army," Emma said. "So what? We'll just..."
She looked at Gabriel.
"What are we going to do?"
Gabriel turned to Wilhelmina.
"How many ways are there out of this valley?"
"Only one. The tunnel through the mountains."
In other words, Michael thought, they were trapped, with Rourke's army between them and the only avenue of escape. Gabriel asked the princess what help they could expect from the elves, but Wilhelmina couldn't say.
"At dawn, I lit a signal fire to tell them that my curse had been lifted. They will come, but to reach us, they will have to pass these creatures."
Emma had knelt back down, and Michael felt her take his right hand. He closed his eyes and imagined it was Kate, and not Wilhelmina, holding his left hand, and that both his sisters were with him.
"We'll get through this," he thought. "I'll get us through this. I have to."
"If Rourke is here," Gabriel said,
and Michael opened his eyes to see the man staring out at the black column of smoke,
"then Dr. Pym cannot be far behind. We have to hope that he or the elves arrive in time to aid us."
"But there must be something we can do,"
Michael said. I mean, isn't there? Gabriel looked at him.
Yes, you can eat your breakfast.
Despite arguing that they had no appetites, a few minutes later Michael and Emma were in the small building along the fortress wall that served as a kitchen, wolfing down bowls of stew.
Whatever happens today, Gabriel had said, you will need all your strength.
And once they had begun to eat, which they did standing beside the fire where Gabriel had made the stew, the children had found that they were famished. Not counting the sausage and dried fruit and bread from the day before, Michael and Emma had not had a proper meal since the outpost cafe on the coast of Antarctica, and already that felt like a lifetime ago. Moreover, the stew was delicious, as Gabriel had found the fortress storerooms chock-full of fresh vegetables, all grown to gigantic sizes in the magically fertile soil of the valley. As Michael and Emma bolted down their stew, Gabriel had gone to look over the fortifications and see what, if anything, could be done. Michael thought about the guardian. When he and Emma had passed through the keep, the man had not looked up, but Michael had heard the guardian's words echoing in his head, "You're not the keeper. You're not the keeper." Emma abruptly lowered her bowl, and what sounded like the war cry of a great prehistoric toad erupted from her throat, filling the entire room. The children looked at each other. Emma seemed nearly as taken aback as Michael.
Sorry?
Uh-huh. But wow!
Then they heard,
Darling Rabbit and his sister, come quickly!
And they dropped their bowls and ran. Arriving in the main courtyard of the fortress, they found 40 elves lined up in neat rows, all kneeling before the princess. Gabriel stood beside Wilhelmina. The first thing that Michael and Emma noticed about the elves, besides the fact that they were, each and every one, astonishingly good-looking, was that they were not dressed like the old-fashioned dandies the children had seen in the clearing the night before. These elves looked like elves out of a fairy tale. Soft leather boots, medieval tunics, vests of silver rings, hooded capes of green and brown. They all had swords at their sides and held smooth wooden bows, while quivers bristling with arrows were slung across their backs. One elf was out in front of the others. He had dark shoulder-length hair, very pale skin, and the bluest eyes that Michael and Emma had ever seen. Indeed, his eyes were so blue that they made the children re-evaluate their whole notion of blue, as if everything they had ever called blue before would now require some new name like not blue, or almost blue, or nothing remotely approaching blue.
"And my father is well?" asked Wilhelmina.
"Save missing you,"
replied the blue-eyed elf.
"Tell me, Captain, what is the state of his hair?"
"Not as lustrous since your captivity, but I'm sure it will regain its natural fullness and bounce once you are home."
"The poor dear. Let us hope so."
The elf princess turned to Michael and Emma. Her smile, Michael had to admit, was radiant, and for once he did not try to smother his thoughts.
"I told you my people would come. This is Captain Anton, the head of my father's guard. Captain, tell your troops to rise."
The blue-eyed elf gave the command, and the rows of elves sprang to their feet. Wilhelmina placed her hand on Michael's shoulder.
"This is the fearless knight who lifted the curse. I owe my life and freedom to him."
The elf captain bowed to Michael.
"You have returned the sun to our skies. Thanks to you, we no longer live in darkness, sir."
"Rabbit,"
said the elf princess. "Actually," Michael said, "my name..."
"Three cheers for Sir Rabbit,"
cried the captain.
"Oh, forget it," Michael grumbled.
And he stood there as 40 elves, with Emma gleefully chiming in, hurrahed the brave Sir Rabbit. There then followed a brief interlude where members of the elfish troop would raise their hands and ask permission to speak. Wilhelmina would grant it, and the elf soldier would compliment some facet of the princess's beauty.
"Your eyes are luminous. They shine like the Andromeda in the coldness of space. Compared to them, diamonds are as lumps of coal. Your chin is a perfect round nub, connoting both firmness of purpose and compassionate pliability. Also, I like your dimple."
"I have composed an ode to the curve of your foot. Oh, sublime foot!"
Finally, Gabriel broke in, asking what the elf captain had seen of Rourke and his army of monsters in the valley. As much as it was possible, the elf's face became grim.
"Very little. We came along the far side of the river, as there was a foul air seeping from the clearing. This man, Rourke, who is he? What does he want?"
"He wants these children," Gabriel said, "and he wants the book that the Guardian was defending."
Then Wilhelmina spoke, and in her voice Michael heard a new, distinctly regal tone.
"Just as the rabbit saved my life, now we have a chance to save his and his sister's. We must be thankful for this opportunity."
The elf captain bowed.
"We are with you and Sir Rabbit to the death, Princess."
Gabriel asked if they could expect reinforcements. The captain shook his head.
"We ourselves did not come expecting war, but merely to escort the princess home, and the rest of our colony will be busy preparing for Princess Wilhelmina's party. If we lit a signal fire, I doubt any would see it."
"Light one anyway," Gabriel said. "A chance of help is better than none at all. In the meantime, we must do what we can."
Michael and Emma were given the task of evaluating the fortress water supply. A search through the storerooms and of the various rain catches revealed 4 large barrels of water, though one of them, Michael admitted, had a good deal of mud floating in it. When he and Emma returned to the courtyard to give their report, they found the siege preparations well underway. Elf soldiers were repairing damaged areas of the ramparts. Other elves were using their knives to fashion arrows, bundles of which were being stationed at intervals along the walls. Another team of elves was buttressing the main doors with thick wooden beams. Even the forge had been lit, and an elf was hammering away at the anvil. Not surprisingly, all the elves were singing, though once Michael heard the words, he decided that he didn't much care for the song. "Oh, such a day for fighting. It may just be our last. The demon hordes are on their way. Tra-la-la-la-la-la. We'll fight for our princess and for her rabbit, dear."
"I wrote it myself,"
Wilhelmina said, skipping toward them.
"When I couldn't think of anything, I just had them say tra-la-la. There's an entire verse about your nose and how generous I am to overlook it."
"Great," Michael said.
"Why aren't they dressed like the elves we saw last night?" Emma asked. "All old-fashioned-y." "Ooh, you're so funny. You can't expect a body to dress the same way every day of the week. We're not dwarves."
"Listen," Michael said, having just about reached his limit. But at that moment, there was a deep rumble, and the earth shook beneath their feet. Michael and Emma grabbed at one another, and Gabriel, who'd been overseeing the work on the main doors, rushed to their side.
"Is that," Michael said, "is that Rourke?"
"No," Gabriel said. "That was something else."
They all turned. A fat black cloud was billowing up from the cone of the volcano.
"That's not good, is it?"
Emma said.
"You think it's because we took the conical out of the lava?" Michael asked, "like somehow it was keeping the volcano stable?"
"If so, there is nothing we can do," Gabriel replied. "Come!"
He led them to a ladder, and the children and Wilhelmina climbed up behind him to where Captain Anton stood on the battlements, staring down at the distant tree line.
"They are massing just inside the forest," said the captain.
Michael marvelled at the elf's eyesight. To him the trees were little more than a large, dark smudge. Gabriel said, "It will not be long now." The singing died away as the elves stopped work and took up their positions. Soon all was quiet save for the steady clink, clink, clink from the forge. Michael glanced left and right at the elves stationed along the walls. They all stared calmly down the slope, bows in hand, full quivers upon their backs. He suddenly felt very small and mean for his years of relentless elf-bashing. Yes, they could be silly, and yes, they spent a great deal of time thinking about their hair, but Michael knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that every elf within the fortress would die to defend him and his sister, and, before the day was over, many of them probably would.
"There,"
Anton said. Michael turned his gaze back down the slope and saw what was coming. He tried to swallow, but his throat was filled with sawdust.
"There's kind of a lot of them, huh?"
Emma said.
"Yeah,"
Michael croaked.
"Kind of."
Rourke's army was pouring out of the forest in a great black tide. There seemed to be no end to it. The creatures just kept coming and coming. Michael tried to count them, but there were too many, and still more continued to stream from the trees. Soon, the entire plain, from the base of the volcano to the edge of the forest, was one dark, teeming, murderous mass. He thought, "We're doomed." And he said out loud, "We'll be okay." And as Michael was beginning to think there really would be no end, that screechers and imps would still be charging from the trees as the front lines swarmed over the fortress walls, the last of Rourke's army finally emerged.
"Trolls!"
the elf captain said, spitting out the word like it was poison. Three massive, grey-skinned creatures had burst awkwardly onto the plain and were moving forward in a sort of lumbering jog, swinging clubs that were half the size of the trees themselves.
"Perfect," Emma said, "'cause it wasn't, like, bad before."
Then, as the first rank scrambled up the boulders at the base of the volcano, the shrieking began. There were hundreds of Moram Cadi among the host, and the cries rose in a dreadful chorus, the din echoing off the canyon walls and doubling back, joining new shrieks and growing even louder. The air trembled, and it seemed to Michael that his heart and lungs were being crushed out of him. Then he heard Emma whispering,
"It's not real. It can't hurt me. It's not real."
And he murmured along with her. The pain eased, and he could breathe again. There was a flash beside him. Gabriel had unsheathed his falchion and was holding it at the ready. The elf captain spoke a single word, and every elf along the walls had an arrow notched to his bowstring. The black horde surged up the slope, close enough now that Michael could see the jagged swords of the screechers, the sea of glowing yellow eyes.
"Both of you," Gabriel said, "go."
But before he could order them away, the horde abruptly stopped, 50 yards from the fortress. They filled the entire slope, pulsing like some vast, terrible beast. The shrieking continued. Michael's gaze travelled over the screechers' ragged uniforms and decaying green bodies, the small, hateful eyes of the imps. Why didn't they attack? Why didn't the elf captain order his troops to shoot? Everyone, defenders and attackers alike, appeared to be waiting. But for what? The answer came as a lone figure was spotted advancing across the plain. Even at a distance, Michael could see Rourke's bald head gleaming in the sun. A path opened in the centre of the host, and Rourke ascended the volcano in long, sure strides. As he came closer, Michael saw that the man was wearing a uniform of some kind. It looked like an old cavalry uniform, high leather boots, breeches flared out wide, a khaki shirt with braids upon the shoulder. In one hand, he held a short riding crop. Reaching the front of the army, Rourke halted and held up the whip. The shrieking stopped.
"A good day to those within."
It was Gabriel who answered.
"You are not welcome here. Leave now. We will give you this one chance."
The bald man laughed.
Will you, then? That is kind indeed.
He shaded his eyes with his hand.
Do I spy wee Michael and Emma hiding among all those pesky elves? My, my, what a chase you've led us on. Why ever did you leave Malpessa so quickly? I so had wanted to make your acquaintance.
The man had an easy, lilting accent that Michael couldn't quite place.
And I could have introduced you to a friend of mine.
Rourke turned, and Michael saw that another figure was making its way across the plain. This figure had none of Rourke's brisk forward momentum, but came on slowly, steadily. It was a man, Michael perceived, of normal size, walking with his head down, as if unsure of his footing. Then, as he picked his way past the large boulders at the foot of the volcano, the man looked up. The sun reflected off his glasses, and Michael felt a hand reach into his chest and seize his heart. He let out a gasp and had to steady himself against the fortress wall.
"Michael," Emma asked, "what is it? Who is that?"
That's... But the word died in his throat. By then, the man was beside Rourke. He wore faded jeans and an old button-down shirt. He had a short beard and reddish-brown hair that was badly in need of a trim. He was visibly thin. His clothes hung loosely on his frame. He looked very tired. Michael felt Emma stiffen. She knew. Still, he had to say it at least once.
"That's... Dad."
Rourke placed his giant's hand on their father's shoulder.
"I'm thinking you've guessed the identity of my friend here. I would only like to point out that he hasn't been harmed in the least. Fit as a fiddle, aren't you, Richard? Go on and tell the kiddies."
The children's father hesitated, as if he were reluctant to be a part of what was happening.
"Speak up, my lad."
And there was an edge of menace in Rourke's voice.
"Don't keep us in suspense. I'm sure Michael and Emma have been worried sick."
Their father finally raised his head. Michael watched his eyes scan the walls and then fix on him and Emma. Seeing them, he seemed to sag slightly.
"I haven't been harmed. Neither of us have. Your mother and I are both well. I'm so sorry about this."
Their father's voice was dry and ragged, but Michael could feel it, like an old key fitting in a long-forgotten lock, opening something deep inside him.
"Sorry?" Rourke exclaimed. "What on earth is there to be sorry about? You're delivering welcome news. Now, kiddies, don't imagine that we've minded having your ma and pa as guests. Become like family, they have. Of course, like family... you do sometimes want to bash their heads in."
He laughed and slapped the children's father on the back.
"Anyway, to business. Can't keep everyone waiting. Don't want your elf mates late for the hairdresser. Here is the deal I'm prepared to offer, and I think you'll find it a very fair one. We, Michael and Emma, will turn themselves and the Chronicle over to me, or I kill dear old Richard on the spot where he stands. Any questions?" "Grand. You have 2 minutes to decide."
So, that's it, Michael thought. This is how it ends. Over the years, Michael had imagined meeting their father, indeed, meeting both their parents many, many times, and he'd always imagined it the same way. There would be all the necessary hugging and kissing and crying, which Michael and his dad would both generously put up with. Then, after his sisters and their mother went off to do girl stuff, Michael wasn't sure what that was, but thought it probably involved more hugging and kissing and crying, he would hand his dad the dwarf omnibus, saying that he had kept it safe for him. And his dad would say something like, "But it's yours." And Michael would reply, "Don't need it. Got it memorized." And after his father had made suitable sounds of being impressed, The two of them would sit down and talk about dwarves all evening. The scene always took place in the evening. The one time Michael had shared this with Emma, she'd told him that it was hands down the weirdest thing she'd ever heard, and that dwarves were not nearly as great as he thought they were. But Emma hadn't understood that it had nothing to do with dwarves. The point was that his father would have seen who Michael was, and he would have liked him. He would have been happy to have spent an evening in his son's company. That was it. That was all Michael wanted. And they could have talked about dwarves or earthquakes or dragonflies or nothing at all. But that was never going to happen. Not now.
"Someone shoot that bald guy!" Emma was shouting at Gabriel and the elf captain. "He's just standing there. What are you waiting for?"
"They can't," Michael said. "The screeches would kill Dad."
"But..."
"Your brother is right. Your father would never make it to the fortress."
Gabriel knelt, bringing his face level with the children's.
"I will only say this. Were it up to me, I would never have you pass into the enemy's power. But this is your decision, and a terrible one to have to make. Whatever you choose, I will not stand in your way."
Michael looked at his sister.
"What do you think?"
Emma was biting her lower lip and glancing feverishly from Michael to Gabriel and back to Michael.
I don't know. Whatever you think.
So it was up to him. Just as, he reflected, it would have been Kate's decision if she were here. Not surprisingly, Michael found himself remembering King Killick's words, "A great leader lives not in his heart, but in his head." Michael believed that. He knew his father believed that. He also knew that the Dire Magnus absolutely could not gain control of the Chronicle. If that happened, all was lost. The logical course of action was clear. There was only one problem. Michael couldn't let his father die.
"I'll trade myself and the Chronicle," he thought, "but not Emma."
"Time's up!" Rourke shouted.
Michael felt Gabriel's hand upon his shoulder, and he raised his gaze to the man's eyes. He apologized silently, and Gabriel nodded. Then Gabriel said,
"Do this for me. Ask to talk to your father. The more we can delay, the better. The wizard may yet come."
"Yeah," Emma said eagerly. "That's a great idea. Go out there and talk and talk, long as you can. Be real boring. You can totally do that."
Michael had made his decision, and now he wanted it over. But he said he would do what they asked, knowing that if it didn't work, he was ready. He looked down the slope. His father's glasses were two bright discs in the sun.
"I want to talk to him first."
Rourke shrugged.
"Very well. Only fair you get to inspect the goods."
Emma hugged him.
"Just talk to Dad. Don't do anything else. Promise?"
Michael promised, without looking her in the eye. Then he turned, feeling the soft brush of Wilhelmina's hand touching his, and followed the elf captain down the ladder and over to the fortress's main doors. There Captain Anton stopped him, speaking in a low voice.
"You give the sign, and my archers will have 20 arrows in that bald giant before he can blink. If your father knows to run, perhaps you can both make it back alive. We will cover you the best we can."
"What should the sign be?"
"You could scratch the back of your head."
"Okay, but what if I just need to scratch my head normally?"
The elf looked at him.
"Resist."
"Oh, okay."
Then the captain gave a signal. The heavy bolts were pulled back, the extra beams removed, and the fortress doors swung open. The elf clapped Michael on the arm.
"Go well, Sir Rabbit."
A moment later, Michael had passed through the gates and was outside the walls, and there was nothing between him and the horde of monsters. He had never felt so exposed. Michael focused on his father's face and began walking, his right hand pressing his bag to his hip, feeling the bulge of the chronicle alongside the familiar shape of the dwarf omnibus. In the whole valley there was only the sound of Michael's boots upon the rocks. He stopped 10 yards from Rourke and his father. The slope here was relatively flat, and Michael had to gaze up into his dad's face. He looked much older than in the photo with Hugo Algernon, much older and much more tired. The beard, too, was new, though Michael thought he looked less like someone who had a beard and more like someone without the time or means to shave. Up close, he was even thinner. His dad smiled sadly.
"I'm so sorry, Michael."
"It's not your fault."
"Are you okay? Are you hurt at all?"
Michael shook his head.
"I'm fine." "And Emma?" "She's okay. She's back there." "But Kate's not with you."
"No, it's a long story." Rourke chuckled.
"True enough, lad. But you'll be seeing your lovely sister before long. Oh, yes, indeed."
Michael sensed that the man knew something about Kate and was taunting him. But Michael wouldn't take the bait. He thought about what the elf captain had said and wondered if he and his dad could actually make it to the fortress.
"So, you know," Rourke said, as if reading his mind, "if those shifty elves try anything, I have 12 Morum Cardi with crossbows who will kill your father before he takes a step."
Well, Michael thought, so much for that.
"Where's Mum? They won't let me say, but she's fine. She sends her love. And she says that whatever you decide, we'll understand. I am happy to see you, even like this."
Michael nodded and said quietly,
"Me too."
They were both silent for a moment.
"I tried."
Michael could hear his voice breaking.
"I did my best." "I know you did," his father said. "It's okay."
"And Kate's not here?" It was all spilling out as the walls that Michael had built up came tumbling down.
"I had to be the leader. I had to make all the decisions. I tried to do what you would have done, like King Killick says."
He paused, overcome, not wanting to cry in front of Rourke. Finally, when he had composed himself, he looked back up. There was confusion on his father's face.
"You know what King Killick says about leadership?"
He stopped, thinking his father would continue. But instead, he saw his father for one flickering moment glance at Rourke.
"I'm sorry, Michael. A lot's happened in the past 10 years. I don't think I remember." "Yes, you do."
And it was suddenly vitally important that his father did remember.
"Dr. Algernon said it was your favourite quote. King Killick said, 'A great leader lives not in his heart, but in his head.' Don't you remember?"
"You have to remember."
"Oh, of course,"
his father said, smiling.
"I always did like that quotation, and it's very true."
And then, without even really understanding what he was doing, Michael said,
"Killick was an old king of the elves."
His father's smile never wavered.
"Yes, I remember now. The elves have a great deal of wisdom. Thank you for reminding me of that."
"Well," Rourke cut in, "this has been a delightful reunion. But we're not here to natter away the day. You and your sister come along, and you have my solemn promise that neither you nor your parents will be harmed. Refuse, and I'll put Richard and every elf in that fortress to the sword, and you will still leave with us. Understand?"
Michael's mind was spinning. His father hadn't remembered the quotation. Then he'd acted like he had, and he'd thought that Killick had been an elf. Had he just forgotten?
"Boy, you're severely testing my patience."
"Okay, but I have to explain it to my sister. I'll bring her out."
He needed to get away. He needed space and time to think about what had happened. He started to turn.
"Wait!"
Rourke had his knife to their father's throat.
"You want to bring out wee Emma yourself,
Fine. Leave the Chronicle.
Michael could feel the tension in the fortress, the hunger coursing through the screechers and imps. It seemed as if all their lives were poised on the edge of Rourke's blade. He reached into his bag and felt for the hard leather cover he knew so well.
"Let my dad hold it, though, just till Emma and I get back."
Rourke smiled.
"Of course."
Michael stepped forward and handed his father the book.
"There's a curse on it. Keep it closed."
He watched as his father ran his hand over the cover.
"I thought it was red.
The order hid it in the lava, so the leather got burned. I'll be right back."
He started up the slope toward the fortress. He had to force himself to go slowly. His heart hammered, his nerves were raw and jangly. He stumbled on loose rocks. Halfway to the gate, he glanced over his shoulder. Rourke was watching him, and the moment their eyes met, perhaps the bald man saw something, or perhaps he was already suspicious. Rourke snatched away the book that Michael had given his father. Michael didn't wait for him to open it and look inside. He was already sprinting forward.
"Stop him!" Rourke shouted. "Stop the boy!"
The cries of screechers tore the air. Michael was 20 yards from the gate when he tripped, sprawling full out upon the rocks. He was up in an instant, but the delay had cost him. He could hear the screechers closing in. Then the elf captain was running out of the fortress, bow outstretched, his hand a blur as he fired a volley of arrows that whistled past Michael's head and shoulders, finding their marks with an accordion-like... The elf grabbed him by the arm, shouting, "Run!" and pulled him on. Then they were through the gate. Michael heard the huge doors slam shut, and he fell to his knees, panting.
"Michael, what happened? Are you all right?"
It was Emma clutching at his arm.
"You gave him the book. And what about Dad? He's still out there."
Michael forced himself to stand.
That's not Dad."
"What do you mean?"
"He forgot this quotation, the one he's supposed to love, and he thought King Killick was an elf. And I gave him the dwarf omnibus, and he thought it was the Chronicle. That's not him."
Michael could see that Emma didn't understand, but there was no more time to explain. Out beyond the walls, Rourke was shouting his name. Quickly, with Emma and the elf captain following, Michael climbed up to the battlements. Wilhelmina rushed toward him as he stepped off the ladder.
"Oh, rabbit, not now," Michael said.
He ran to the wall. Gabriel was already there, staring down the slope. Below them, Rourke had a knife at the throat of the man Michael no longer believed to be his father. The dwarf omnibus lay upon the ground.
"Lad, I'm giving you one last chance."
Michael turned toward Emma.
"Listen, I know you don't trust me."
"What? What are you talking about?"
"I mean, not the way you used to. And I understand, but you have to trust me now. That's not our dad."
Emma stared at him, and even without the power of the Chronicle, Michael saw the pain of his betrayal still so fresh inside her. It was awful to see it, awful to know that he was responsible, but he didn't look away. He knew what it was he was asking.
"You're sure?" she said. "Like 100% sure?"
Was he that sure? Was it even possible? Even with all the evidence, forgetting the quotation, mistaking Killick for an elf, not recognizing the dwarf omnibus, with all that, there was still room for doubt. There was no way to be 100% sure, but Michael knew, in his gut and in his heart, that that man was not their father.
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Okay," she said. "I trust you."
Michael turned to the elf captain. "Shoot him."
"The bald man, with pleasure."
He notched an arrow and drew it back.
"No,"
Michael said. "The man pretending to be our dad." Emma, the captain, Gabriel and Wilhelmina all stared at him.
"You are certain of this?"
Gabriel asked.
"Yes."
He took Emma's hand, felt how it trembled. That's not our dad. Emma's eyes darted nervously from Michael to Gabriel. She was scared, but she was with him. She nodded.
Boy!
There was a soft twang, and then the shaft of an arrow was protruding from the chest of the man beside Rourke. The mountainside fell silent.
Michael!
Emma gripped his arm. Wait! The man slumped to his knees and fell forward onto the black rocks. Michael stayed absolutely still. He didn't blink. He didn't breathe. Then Rourke began to laugh, a deep, rolling laugh that echoed all through the canyon. With his boot, he flipped the man over. Their father had disappeared. In his place lay a short, sandy-haired man with an arrow in his chest.
He was wearing a glamour,
Wilhelmina cried.
Rabbit, you're a genius.
She seized him and kissed his cheek. My dad would never mistake the dwarf omnibus, Michael said, trying not to show his relief. Or think that King Killick was an elf. Ridiculous. Then he looked at Emma and squeezed her hand. Thanks for trusting me. Emma said nothing, but hugged him tightly.
Well, lad, Rourke shouted, I guess we'll do this the old-fashioned way.
He turned to his horde.
Bring me the children. Kill the rest.
And so the battle began. Chapter 18. Henrietta Burke's Last Wish.
What do you mean? Who's burning the church? The imps?
Kate, Rafe, and Beatles were standing in the middle of the street as the revelers continued to spin and dance about them. Rafe had grabbed Beatles by his jacket.
Ain't the imps, Beatles cried, his eyes wild. It's humans. There are mobs all over the city, going after anything to do with magic.
But the church is hidden, Kate said. It's supposed to be invisible.
The boy shook his head.
Not no more.
Rafe said, what happened to Skuggs?
He was with you, right? Went to the imp mansion.
But he didn't come in. After he gave me the glamour, he stayed in the street.
Yeah, well, coming back to the church, he ran into a mob going after these two witches. Skuggs stopped them, but someone threw a brick or a rock or something and clapped him smack on the head. He's dead, Skuggs is.
Skuggs is dead?
Kate was stunned.
Sure. Them two witches brought him back to the church, told us what happened. I was there when they brought him in. He said, I'm thirsty, then fell down dead as dead. Second later, bang, the church was there for everyone to see. People on the street started shouting and pointing. Wasn't a half hour later the mob came. They had torches and guns.
And they knew, Rafe said. They knew there were kids inside.
Sure they knew, Beatles said. Miss B told them. They didn't care. They just started burning the church.
Rafe charged through the crowd, disappearing down the darkened street. Beatles took off after him, and it was all Kate could do to keep up. The long coat hampered her legs, and the boots the gnomes had given her kept slipping on the snow and ice. It was quickly apparent that Beatles was telling the truth. On street after street, they passed gangs of men, sometimes bands of three or four, sometimes a dozen, moving through the city with torches and burning anything that hinted of magic. Kate wondered how she and Rafe hadn't seen or heard the mobs before, but then perhaps they had, only from a distance. The shouting and the torches were easily mistaken for celebration. It seemed to Kate as if a madness had taken hold of the city, as if people could sense the coming change and knew this was their last chance to vent their rage before the magic world disappeared.
"What time is it?"
she shouted to Beatles as the two of them raced through the streets.
"Past 11. Got less than an hour till the separation.
Where's everyone else? Where's Jake and Abigail?"
"Dunno. The mob was all around the church, and Miss B told me to go find Rafe. She thought he might have taken you down there. What were you two doing?"
Kate didn't respond. By then she could see the flames against the night sky and hear the shouting, and when they came around the last corner, Kate was stopped dead by the sight before her. The church was completely engulfed in flames. The snow melted for a dozen yards all around it. A crowd had gathered in the street. Many people waved torches and appeared to be cheering on the fire. She didn't see Rafe.
Over here!
Beatles was sprinting toward an alley across the street from the church. She followed him, and there, huddled between the buildings, were Abigail and 20 other small children. Their faces were streaked with soot, and their eyes were large and filled with fear. Abigail immediately threw herself into Kate's arms.
"You're okay?" Kate asked, hugging the girl tightly. "You're all okay?"
Abigail nodded and wiped at her eyes, tears smearing the ash on her cheeks.
"Miss B sent us out the side door. Whole place was on fire. But she went back in. Said there were others she had to get out. She's still in there."
"What about Jake?" Beatles demanded. "You see Jake get out all right?"
The girl shook her head.
"He'll be okay," Kate told him. "He'll get out."
Even as they were talking, another group of children came running into the alley. They were covered in soot and terrified. They said they had been trapped inside the church, but that Rafe had broken through the door and led them outside. Kate could see Beatles looking around frantically. He seemed on the verge of tears.
"Where's Jake? Somebody must have seen Jake. Who's seen him get out?"
The children all shook their heads.
"I seen him in the church," one girl said. "I thought he was coming with us. I don't know where he is."
Without another word, Beatles sprinted off toward the church. Kate looked at Abigail.
"Is there somewhere safe you can go?"
Abigail nodded.
"The Bowery Theatre, down near the Magic Quarter. The manager's a friend of Miss B's." "Go there, then," Kate said. "You're in charge. You can do this."
Watching Abigail push out her jaw and square her shoulders, Kate was reminded again of Emma. The young girl turned to face the other children.
"Right! Everybody find someone else to hold hands with. We're going downtown."
The children moved about, finding buddies.
"What about you?"
Abigail asked Kate.
"I'm going after Beatles."
And she turned and ran toward the fire. The church stood at the corner of First Avenue and a narrow cross street, and the mob was massed along the avenue. There were men and boys, and they held torches and knives and clubs. They were all shouting and laughing and cheering, and they threw rocks and bottles crashing through the church's remaining windows, their faces red and demonic in the light from the blaze. Kate lingered for a moment at the back of the crowd.
How could they do this? She wondered. Where could so much hatred come from? These were children living here. They'd done nothing wrong.
Kate felt anger welling up inside her. She wanted to lash out at the mob, to hurt them. And it flickered through her mind that this must be how Rafe felt all the time. Forcing herself to focus, she ran around the mob to the cross street behind the church. There was a wall separating the church from the houses on the block, and Kate ran alongside it. The heat from the fire was tremendous and stung her face. Beatles was throwing himself against a flaming door again and again. Kate pulled him back.
"Stop! It's too dangerous!"
"He's still in there,"
Beatles sobbed, struggling to get free.
"Jake's still in there. Let me go. I gotta..."
The door exploded outward. Black smoke billowed forth, and figures stumbled out. A dozen children, 17, 18, bent over and hacking, their faces blackened with smoke. Kate led them away, checking each one to make sure that he or she was okay. Jake was not among the children, and Kate turned and saw Beatles shielding his eyes and edging toward the door. She caught the boy as he made to leap.
"Let go of me! I gotta..."
Just then, another figure emerged from the smoke. Kate saw that it was Rafe, and he was holding a child in his arms. Beatles went limp against Kate.
"Is that..."
he said.
"Is he?"
For it was Jake whom Rafe was carrying, and the younger boy's face was smoke-stained, and his eyes were shut. Kate felt her heart clench like a fist. "No," she thought. "Please, no." Then the boy coughed thickly and blinked, his eyes red and watery. He saw Kate and Beatles.
"Hey!
Hey!"
Beatles said, crying and smiling at the same time. Kate reached out and touched the boy's hair.
"What were you doing in there? Thinking about opening a shop?"
Jake smiled and said weakly.
Yeah, the burning down the church shop.
Rafe set the boy on his feet, and Beatles put his arm around his friend.
That's all the kids.
Rafe's face was smoke black, and his voice raw.
Where are the ones who are already out?
Abigail led them downtown, Kate said, to the Bowery Theatre. She said the manager's a friend of Miss Burke's.
Rafe looked at Beatles.
You heard that? You can take those other kids down there.
Course,
Beatles said, all his old confidence restored.
Hey, listen up. All you savages, follow me.
And with Jake's arm over his shoulder, he led the children away. Kate and Rafe were alone for only a moment when there was a crashing inside the church, then a loud metallic clang that was audible even over the roaring of the flames.
One of the bells,
Rafe said.
It fell out of the tower.
He started back into the church, but Kate caught his arm.
What are you doing? All the kids are out.
I'm gonna get Miss B.
He pulled free and disappeared into the smoke. Kate didn't hesitate, but plunged in after him. Indeed, even if she'd thought longer about her responsibilities to Michael and Emma, to her parents, about the fact that despite everything, Rafe might still become her enemy, she would have acted the same. Just like Dr. Pym and Gabriel and King Robbie MacLauer, Rafe had put himself in danger to protect her and, through that, her family. Now he needed her help. She kept her head down and one arm up and before her face. The heat scorched her skin, the smoke burned her eyes, but then she was through to the main hall of the church, where the ceilings were so high that the smoke collected far above. She pulled off her coat and dropped it to the floor. The air burned her throat and lungs, and she wondered how long till the whole church